Good evening. Thank Landon for reading. So we're in chapter 8, starting in verse 18. And we just got done with the Beatitudes. And in the last week, earlier in this chapter, we saw a couple miracles by Jesus. Healing of the leper and healing of Peter's mother-in-law. In verse 5, we see that, so he's come down from the mountain, and we don't really know where the mountain is, but in verse 5, we see that all that took place in Capernaum. So it's my assumption that the first couple verses here this evening probably take place in Capernaum, and then we move across the Sea of Galilee. We found this neat 3D map here. There's another one following this. It's kind of neat too. Kind of gives you perspective of where everything's at and how far down the valley the Sea of Galilee is. Just ask Bart if it really looks like that. So the first question covers verses 18 to 20. And again, let's read those again. And when Jesus saw... And when Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave command to depart to the other side. Then a certain scribe came and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." And I forgot to write down who had the last question. So Trace had the last question.
No.
You're the first. So Trace volunteers to answer this question. Why did the living accommodations of Jesus affect the scribe who wanted to follow him?
As we probably all know, Jesus was constantly on the go, constantly traveling, and evangelizing and preaching God to everyone. I think verse 20 well explains they have a lack of accommodations, but at the same time you could say that they're well blessed by God and looked after. But they also have, it's a tough situation because lots of them are receiving him right now, but eventually. It's, the Pharisees and the Sadducees are kind of, they're working against him. He says, Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. So he didn't have a safe place to lay his head down. So it's kind of sad. But there's a parallel verse, Luke 9, 58, that says the same thing.
All right. Luke 9:58. Jesus said to him, same thing. Foxes have holes and birds in the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Who else would like to address why the living conditions of Jesus affect the scribe who wanted to follow him? Awesome.
Similar to what Trace said, he was always on the move. We understand in Mark chapter 2, verse 1, that there was a house that they frequented, that they lived in, but that wasn't, that's Mark chapter 2, verse 1. He resided in a house in Capernaum, but obviously with as often as he was on the move, that wasn't his permanent address. But I don't know that it's entirely the point of where Jesus' location was. Obviously that... it didn't affect Jesus, didn't bother Jesus in that form, but perhaps more as a rebuke to this eager volunteer that the life that he was volunteering for was not the life that he thought it was going to be. I seriously doubt that when he said he was going to follow Jesus wherever he went, that he would know where all Jesus was planning on going. And in the different circumstances, we sing the song about following in the footsteps of Jesus, though they lead through the temple holy, and other things, which slipped my mind at this time. Where Jesus goes, I don't think is where this man thought he was going to go. And it wasn't going to be the life of stability or luxury or monetarily based that perhaps he thought it might have been. And I don't think he did end up following Jesus after that. I think after he told him this, it was something that discouraged him from doing so.
Okay. What else would you like to address? Bill?
I came across something that I hadn't seen or read that I can remember. It was suggested that this scribe might have seen this group that was with Jesus and thought, I'm a scribe, these are fishermen. I can get in this group and be this man, this leader's second in command. I don't think I'd ever heard that before or read that before. Wow, that's kind of an interesting thought. I don't know that we really, I don't know that we know how it impacted this scribe.
Legitimize his ministry with an official scribe. Who else would like to address this? Some of the commentators I saw, speculated that this scribe was convinced after he saw these miracles and heard his preaching that he was the Messiah, and expecting the wrong kind of Messiah, and he thought, I can get in on the ground floor of this and I'll be great in the kingdom. It'd be like buying a stock, if you could look back 20 years and buy Amazon or something. That type of thing. Who else would like to address this question? All right, let's move on to verses 21 and 22. So this is another. Then another of his disciples said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. But Jesus said to him, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. Landon, would you like to address this? Or the question is, why didn't Jesus want this man to bury his father?
So what I have here is just a quote from Kaufman. I'm just going to read it verbatim. And Kaufman says, he meant that he was not free to be a disciple until after the death of his father, but that he would be glad to follow Jesus after his father died. In a response which seems harsh, if not understood in its true meaning, Jesus allowed no delay, encouraged no procrastination, and commanded those spiritually dead should be left to bury their own dead. And later he writes, regardless of the cost or inconvenience, we must fully commit to the service.
Good. Who else has something to talk?
Yeah, I think of these two individuals as like polar opposites. That's kind of the way I'm seeing this section. And the first guy, described in question one, he's filled with exuberance and excitement. He sees these great crowd multitudes, right? As has been mentioned, he sees multitudes, and so he's ready to go. But Jesus can see into his heart and knows that he's going to have issues with the scarcity of food food necessarily, but at least a place to stay. And so he sees that his exuberance is going to quickly melt away. And then this fellow in the second question here is kind of the opposite. He also is interested. He believes. He's a believer. And both these guys believe in Christ, which just says something for them. But the second individual here, he believes, but he has a worldly concern tugging at him. And that is, he wants to wait until his father is dead. So as Landon pointed out, that his father's not dying that day, that week. but he's elderly and infirm, and he wants to wait until that time, maybe 6 months, a year, whatever, and then follow after Jesus. And so Jesus sees into his heart, too, and sees that that is also a problem. So it's interesting. It is, there's a high standard here. These are believers. These are individuals. And so you can't help but apply it to your own life and, you know, think about how much we equivocate or how we commit to a cause, maybe in a business meeting or at our evangelism study or whatever it is. We commit to a cause and then we don't follow through. Or conversely, we don't commit because, you know, we have worldly concerns. So it's just like Jesus is saying, you must, put yourself to the plow and not look back and continue the labor.
Very good. And to your point, when we see this in the verse after Trace mentioned before, Luke 9:59, it's Jesus says to this guy, follow me, unlike the guy before where he volunteers that. So it's kind of the opposite view. Okay. Anyone else? Matt?
It stood out to me that both of these men have problems, but Jesus doesn't discourage either of them from coming with him. He tells the first man, we don't have it recorded here, saying, yeah, come along, but he says, I'll come along, and Jesus says, you're not going to have anywhere for sure to sleep, but he doesn't say, don't come, and this guy, he says, come now, don't wait, and these are flawed people, and I'm sure everyone can relate to one of them, if not both of them. We have moments where we are ready to go, and we are excited, and other times we say, well, I have other things that I need to do. And Jesus doesn't discourage us in either of those moments to stop following him, but keep our priorities straight.
Anyone else? Awesome.
You know, there's almost a sermon to be preached from this, and the fact that there's a lot of people that are waiting for everything to fall into place. That appears to be the case with this man who's basically waiting for his father to die so he can take care of his estate and do whatever's necessary. Waiting for all their ducks to line up in a row, and then they'll take action. Then they'll change this, that, or the other. When you have to change something in your life, particularly when it comes to Jesus Christ, there is no time for delay, and there's no better time than the present, than right now. Because any moment spent worrying about anything else, and that's a large portion of what the Sermon on the Mount was, that nothing in this life compares to that. You have to seek first the kingdom of God, and then all these things shall be added unto you. So, if you're waiting for everything to fall in line, that's the entire wrong attitude, and that's what he admonishes this man to do. Don't wait for everything to go exactly the way you want it to. I'm more important than that.
Yeah, that's a good point. This is right after the Sermon on the Mount. This might be like the preacher encouraging somebody after services to obey the gospel. Anybody else? I think it was Barnes that made the point, you know, if this guy goes back to his family, he's going to fall back into his own ways. Jesus likely knew this, and then he would lose his zeal and probably never return. All right, let's move on to the next section, verses 24 to 27. And we have missed a key point. Verse 23, he gets in a boat. His disciples follow. And then verses 24 to 27. And suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with waves, and he was asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we are perishing. But he said to them, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, who can this be that even the winds and sea obey him? Levi, would you like to tell us what we can learn from the miracle of Jesus rebuking the storm?
So I kind of took it as what can the people like around him learn from this miracle. And that's why I kind of like this question format, because if I, interpret the question wrong or mess up a little bit, other people can, help me out there. But there's two things that happen in this chapter. There's an exorcism, there's a natural disaster. And I think what's so big about this miracle right here is that the man who's doing this coming to be the Son of God, like Moses, splitting the sea, he wasn't claiming to be the Son of God. And also, I thought it was interesting that Jesus didn't have any object in his hands. He just rebuked the sea. Moses had a staff, but Jesus just rebuked the sea, and it calmed down. Same with the exorcism. He didn't have any special object in his hand. So that's what I thought was interesting about that.
Very good. It's not messing up. We just see things differently. Thank you. Who else would like to address what we can learn from the miracle of Jesus rebuking the storm?
Through something else, Levi answered very well, but I found it interesting. He rebuked them. He was asleep. They wake him up during the storm, and he rebukes them for being afraid and having little faith before he calms the storm. So it wasn't the fact, I don't think he was asleep because he knew he could calm the storm. I don't think that he rebukes them simply because there is a storm, but the fact that they were worrying about something that they had no control over. They weren't putting their trust in God. They weren't calling out to him. They were afraid of everything that was going on around them, and Jesus was not. Now, could the fact that he had control and the power to speak and the winds be still affect that? Maybe. But I think it's living out the principle, and this is kind of a pattern I'm seeing here after the Sermon on the Mount. He's living out the principle that he already established, that you can't, through worrying, you can't affect one thing or another. You can't make one hair on your head black or white. You can't add a cubit to your stature. You can't do anything through worrying. The only thing you can do is rely on God. And the disciples weren't relying on God, and they were kind of asking Jesus to bail them out, if you will, or at least care a little bit enough to wake up and do something. But they weren't putting their trust where it needed to be.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about it. And we just had a sermon somewhere up in here probably about worry not. And now they're worried. Who else would like to address what we can learn from this rebuking of the sea and the wind and the storm? Bill.
Well, verse 27 makes it pretty clear that the disciples didn't really know who this guy was that they were following. And it was touched on a little earlier, and I think that's pretty powerful and insightful.
I hadn't ever really thought of this as a comical scene, but it is. When the disciples are freaking out, and you see Jesus in your mind's eye, you see him sleeping in the middle of all of this, and they run over to him and wake him up. And you can see Jesus being human, slowly waking up and taking in the surroundings, probably being irritated that he was woken up. And then he gets up and stops the storm. And then I'm sure they all felt ridiculous after that. He said, this is not a big deal, and then stopped it. And Mark's account tells us that there were other smaller boats with him. So more people witnessed this, and I'm sure were panicking. And when Jesus gets up and stops it, it's not just the disciples that saw this happen. It's these people that followed him. Well.
Right. Yeah, there probably a lot of people could see this from the shores. And yes, it's one of the things that I appreciated from this was that Jesus was tired and he fell asleep, being one who likes to fall asleep wherever I'm at. Anybody else like to address this? We do see kind of a parallel to Jonah. So Jonah is kind of the opposite. Jonah is asleep and he's done wickedness and he's in the bottom of the boat. And Jesus, he's got a clear conscience. So I don't know how we can weigh those two against each other. But Jonah's, he's done great wickedness and he knows that he's the cause of the storm. But Jesus is, he knows that he has power over these things. That's another thing that we can learn from this, that, you know, kind of Bill's point that Jesus is the creator and he has power over nature. That's one of the things shown from this. Now, this was kind of interesting. Kaufman said, he didn't say this, but he quoted somebody that said this. I'm not necessarily agreeing with this, but it was an interesting observation that Jesus rebuked the storm and says, it's kind of a personification of it. And this commentator that Kaufman quoted was placing Satan behind the storm. And then you also, if you contrast that to what you see in Jonah, where in Jonah 1:4 it says, the Lord caused the storm for Jonah. It's a kind of interesting contrast. Anybody else before we move on? Question number 4. And this covers verses 28 through 34. I'm not going to read all of those again because it's fairly long. And there are two other accounts that are very long. And the question is, what are some of the differences between the accounts found in Mark 5, 1 to 19, Luke 8, 26 to 40, and should these differences make us doubt the validity of scriptural accounts? And Bart, would you like to address this?
I have to admit I'm a little overwhelmed by this question. A lot of material covered here. So this is an important, you know, Smith gave us an amazing sermon on this, and I thought maybe I should re-listen to it, and I didn't get it done. But this is a Gentile area. It's one of the cities of the Decapolis where this event occurs, the Gadara. So it's a Gentile area, and that's why the pigs are seen in this area. I remember when I was a child, no one explained that, and I was always like, why do the Jews have pigs? I don't understand. So I appreciated that discussion of Smith's. And so it's east of the Jordan, and there's a lot of radical concepts going on here in this. This is travel to a new location. There's no other exorcism of Jesus where he travels into the Gentile area, as far as I know. Further, this is the only time that Jesus requests the name of demons involved when he's casting out demons, again, as far as I know. And to your Jonah analogy, I think that's very intuitive, because if you consider the Jonah situation, Jonah was asked to be sent to the Gentiles. He was told to go to the Gentiles. And then you have that event, which has many parallels with this event, and the waters are calmed. Of course, Jonah's cast into the waters. Jesus later dies, you know, he is put to death. So there's parallels here. But Jonah, 3 days and three nights. Jesus, 3 days and three nights, and you know, in death. So, number of parallels. And then Jonah goes reluctantly to the Gentiles and to convert the Gentiles. Jesus goes willingly to the Gentiles. And this would be a shock and a surprise. You know, we're not really told that in the text. But this would be horrifying to a good Jew, that you would wander around in Gentile area. And then two exorcisms occur. Jonah reluctantly causes an exorcism of evil out of the city of Assyria, that Nineveh, that is going to be destroyed, and Jesus exorcises a demon out of two men. And so that's the main difference between the accounts, the synoptic accounts, are the number of demon-possessed men, and we know it's two, Matthew tells us that it's two, but Luke and Mark just chose to focus on one. And why did they do that? Well, the writers have a theological agenda. And I really believe that this event is directly related to the Jonah story. And I think we miss it because, you know, we're so far away. But I think people that would read the scripture in that time would understand. So the writer has a theological emphasis. All three of these synoptic writers have theological points of view. They're looking at it from a different perspective, and they're trying to get a point across. And we don't understand the point sometimes. We're not getting every nuance. These are the Holy Spirit is the greatest writer, you know, ever. Obviously, God is the greatest writer ever. So there's multiple points. So it's not a faith challenging. It shouldn't be a faith challenging thing. If we're weak in faith, then we say, well, these accounts are different. The truth is, we need to think about these accounts, study them, compare and contrast. And as far as a couple other things, and maybe people have other differences, Mark and Luke tell us that after the casting out of the demons, these two men, or at least the man, was clothed sitting at Jesus' feet. And then Mark records it was 2,000 pigs that ran down. That's all.
Who else would like to address? Thank you. Who else would like to address the differences, and if that makes us doubt the validity? Mark touched on more differences than I had. I saw the one and two men. There is another thing, the location. Matthew says Gergesenes, and both Mark and Luke say Gadarenes, which are different locations. And the commentators I read thought that, this is the Decapolis. There maybe, I don't know which one of them was the center. Well, I had it written down here. Gadara was 10 kilometers from the shore. Gergesa was 20, and that Gergesa was probably the regional power, where Gadara was more the local power. So, speaking to people who were less familiar with the region, that would be what Mark and Luke are talking to, and Matthew would be, actually it's vice versa. Matthew would be talking to people who are less familiar with it, and Mark and Luke would be talking to people more familiar. Who else would like to address this? Another thing was, a lot of the people were talking about the geography, and neither one of those cities was close enough for the pigs to jump into the lake. So it was just kind of a regional thing that you would have to know the region to understand that, kind of Bart's point of the people would get more out of it, knowing the area and the culture. Another thing that we saw, see in Luke 8:27, is that it was a man, the man that Luke and Mark talk about was from the city. So perhaps he was a more prominent, known man than the other one that Matthew also mentions. Something I found interesting too was we hear about the Golan Heights all the time on the news, and so this is in that region. And I also thought about Nebuchadnezzar. Chapter 4, he becomes like a cow. You know, this is the same type of thing where I don't know that it was necessarily a demon in heaven, Nebuchadnezzar, but these guys were out of their mind and were acting like animals in these tombs. Anybody else before we go on to the next question? Matt.
Matthew says at the end of this account that the people of this area begged Jesus to leave. And at the end of Mark's account, he tells the man who wants to go with him, the man that he cast the demons out of, he says, go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you, and says that man went back to Decapolis and told the people what Jesus had done and all marveled. So it seems that them begging Jesus to leave was not necessarily because they didn't like Jesus. It's probably because they were unsure of what was going on. They might, marveling doesn't mean that they are ready to embrace him. They may be scared of what has happened. This is a terrifying scene to me. These demons and pigs. It's one of the most troubling scenes to me in most of the Bible. And so, hearing about this, I can see why they may not want Jesus to stick around. But this man certainly believed, and he certainly went and told everybody about it too.
Yes. Fine. The question I always had is, this is off the topic, but where did the demons go after they drowned the pigs? I've often wondered what happened there. Let's go on to question number 5. And maybe we'll understand this if somebody answers question number 5. How does demon possession take place? What can this account teach us about demon possession? Logan, would you like to address that?
Well, I don't think I'll be able to answer your question there. But this question's a little odd. We know that these demons refer to Jesus as the Most High God. And that's interesting. They acknowledge his power. And I believe this latter half of the chapter is all about Jesus' power. They're crossing the sea here when they arrive. And in both those instances, Jesus is displaying his power. As for what this teaches us about demonic possession, it's not pretty. It's pretty frightening. The thought I had was, let's say you're a Jewish disciple, you're following Jesus, and you get on the boat, and you experience the storm. That's terrifying. And that's over, you know, the waters have stilled, and you start coming towards Gergeser, however you say that. And you see these two silhouettes, you know, as you're coming towards, because say the men met them when they come there. So what are you thinking at that moment when these men are maybe shouting or hollering or whatever? That's got to be an interesting experience. But in both these instances, Jesus displays his power. So that's all I really got.
Who else would like to talk about demon possession? What this teaches us on that. Wes.
I'm glad I didn't have this question. Because I also don't have an answer, and it led me into a long journey to try to answer the question. But one thing that comes up again and again is that, and we see it here, that multiple demons can possess someone. And so we see that here, where Jesus asks their name and they say Legion in Luke's account, because many demons had entered him, it says. We see in Mark 1, when Jesus casts out the unclean spirit, the spirit uses the word us and uses the plural. Mary Magdalene had 7 demons cast out of her. In Matthew 12, again, as mentioned earlier, where Jesus is talking about Jonah and talking about Nineveh, he says that people who have an unclean spirit cast out and then return to the place that caused it will have 7-fold demons return to them. And so many demons can possess someone, and demons can also possess animals from this account. And one thing I thought maybe Austin was getting at in writing this question about how does demon possession happen is that it was only through supernatural, superhuman abilities that Jesus was able to transfer these demons. And so demon possession happens through supernatural occurrences. And so the demons, potentially that could be an answer. That in the same way Jesus was able to take the demons and put them into animals, Satan was able to put the demons into people. I'm not sure exactly if we have an answer, but it's a theory. I think I had something else, maybe I'll think of it in a minute.
Thank you. Anybody else on demon possession? Awesome.
Similar to Wes, when I started digging into this topic a little more, it's got so many verses about it, and it's something I certainly haven't studied out nearly as well as it definitely deserves. Demon possession doesn't, I don't recall of an instance where it takes place in the Old Testament. I may be wrong in that, and if I am, somebody please correct me on that, but it seems like something we only just hear about coming into the New Testament, but also something people were familiar enough with that Jesus refers to it in his Sermon on the Mount, as people, the hypocrites, will come forward on Judgment Day saying that we've cast out devils in your name. So it's something that the people of that era knew about. It wasn't necessarily a new thing, but as to why we don't hear about it in the Old Testament, I'm not sure. I don't know if this is something where they're allowed to possess people to prove Jesus as the Messiah in this way. That's just a question I don't know the answer to, but it's something that came up in my studies. It affected men, women, and children. There was no partiality with that. As Wes mentioned, demons can repossess you. Something that literally takes over a human being so that there's not a shred of them left. It gives them abilities that are superhuman, such as strength, or the ability of divination, is in Acts, in the book of Acts. I don't remember the chapter. Cause people to hurt themselves, foam at the mouth, do a number of different things. And I saw, as I was going through looking at some articles, people were saying that now, today, in our modern medicine times, that demon possession can be explained away as people with epilepsy. That it's just one of those type of conditions, that's what is transpiring. And actually the Bible knows what epilepsy is and distinguishes between the two in Matthew chapter 4. Verse 24, it says, "His fame went throughout all Syria and brought unto him all sick people that were taken with divers diseases and torments, and those which were possessed with devils, and those which were lunatic." Lunatic being those with epilepsy. I'm not sure what other translations translate that as. Those that had the palsy. It can make people look like they have epilepsy, which is what happens in Matthew chapter 17, verse 15. But there's so much information about demon possession, but as to why they were allowed to, I'm not sure. My best guess is that it was used in a way that would prove the power of Jesus and then later the apostles over the devils. I just don't know. All right.
One sentence edition.
You asked what happened to the demons after they ran into the sea. I had a similar question. In Matthew and Mark's account, the demons asked to be put into the pigs. In Luke's account, they add to that, verse 31 of Luke 8, they begged him that he would not command them to go out into the abyss. And so my question is, or was, maybe I have an answer, is that why didn't Jesus just cast them into the abyss? Why would he let these demons have their way? They wanted to go in the pigs. He could have done, could have cast them into the abyss, whatever that involves, something they did not want, and he appeased them and did what they wanted. And so I have a theory. It's completely my own theory. It might be way off. When Jesus is healing leprosy, or he's healing a severe fever like we saw earlier, those are physical symptoms, and it's easy to see that the healing took place. With something like demon possession, it might have been more of like a mental illness, and something that it's harder to see, is the person just temporarily feeling better? Is it going to come back? And so going into the pigs was a physical, obvious manifestation that demon has left here, and it is here, and watch those pigs run away, and then see that this person is well again. And so maybe he did it on purpose to make that more apparent.
Very good. Explains why he put him there. doesn't explain where they went after. Few points that I saw and was that these demons are always destructive. The men cut themselves, the pigs committed suicide, and kind of to Wes's earlier point, they have to ask, they know who Jesus is, verse 29, James 2:19, and they have to ask God's permission to act. We need to move on to the next last question, and this deals with verse 34. And behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they begged him to depart from the region. Why did the people ask Jesus to depart from them? Wes.
So, Matt speculated earlier that being marveled might have meant being afraid. If we look at Luke's account, it says specifically that they were afraid. Luke 8:35 says, they went to see what had happened and came to Jesus, found the man, and so on, and they were afraid. And then it adds even more. Then the whole multitude, in verse 37, in the surrounding region of the Gadarenes, asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. And so they asked him to leave because they were terrified.
I'm scared. What else? Awesome.
That's the same conclusion I came to, but Matt mentioned, I think it was Mark's account, Luke's account, about the formerly demon-possessed man. He asked to go with Jesus. Jesus tells him to stay put and to tell everyone about what has happened to you. He does that, and verses 39 and 40, well, return to thine house, show how great things God had done to thee, and he went his way, published throughout the whole city how great things Jesus had done unto him. And it came to pass that when Jesus was returned, the people gladly received him, for they were all waiting for him. So this is one of the best examples of personal evangelism that there is, because he was able to share his story to such an extent that when Jesus, there was a time when they wanted Jesus completely out. They were afraid, for whatever reason. Maybe it was just the lack of pigs. They didn't want any more pigs destroyed, and they were afraid of that. But for a number of reasons, they wanted Jesus gone. But once they heard someone preach about Jesus, they were waiting for him and ready for him to come and were glad to receive him. So just a remarkable difference between the two.
Are you? Yeah, I raised pigs when I was in high school. About $100 a pig, so this has been 200K that would have went into the ocean in 1980s prices. So pigs don't bring that anymore. But to your point, and Bart mentioned earlier, Smith Bibbins' 2018 sermon, and his point of that was in Mark 7:31-37. Jesus goes back to that area, he heals a deaf man, and the multitudes welcomed him. So this was a very pointed evangelism effort. Anybody else before we close? So at this time, if you're not a Christian, we offer that opportunity.